Back then, we just had no support, no community for people like us to come for that information, that guidance, that just that sense of spirit and celebration and visibility of families like ours, to usualise families like ours, that people would invalidate my role. So no one told me that someone would, the day after our daughter had been born, turn around and say, I don't want her, get her out, I want the real mum. My identity isn't just about being gay. I'm a mother, I'm a wife, I'm a daughter, I'm a sister, I'm a friend. There's so many parts to me. Gay dads and gay mums, we're a bit more accepted, that's fine, but what about trans, what about non-binary people, genderqueer people, what about co-parenting, what about polyfamilies, what about intersex people, what about all these people that are even smaller minority community within our community?
Hi, I'm Sanjay Sood Smith, pronouns he, him, and welcome to the Proud Parent Club, the inclusive LGBTQ plus parenting community. And today's guest is Laura Rose Thorogood, who is founder of the organisation LGBT Mummies and also a mum to three through IUI and IVF. Hi, Laura Rose.
Hi, how are you, Sanjay?
I'm very good. How are you?
Good, busy. It's the end of the week. It's like I survived. I'm alive.
I know. Made it through. Tomorrow. We've got one more day to go, but we'll get yeah. there. Tell me a bit about you. Talk to me about you and your relationship and how you became a parent.
So my wife and I have been together like 15 years now. We've been married 12. We started our journey over a decade ago. We got engaged, got married. I forced her into marriage, of course. and then we decided, you know, we wanted to start a family. We really didn't know where to look. Back then, social media wasn't so prevalent and not really anyone in our community at the time was having kids. Everyone was still out having fun partying and we were like, no, we want to settle down. So we kind of had to muddle through it on our own. It was quite isolating and difficult to get that information or hear of other people's with lived experience, like how much did it cost? Where do you go? What sperm bank do you use? All those kind of things. What are the legalities around everything?
Yeah.
So we kind of muddled our way through it and we started our family. We used a clinic in London, CRGH, and we used Zytex Sperm Bank in America. So we made our decision what our path was and we tried for a baby. So we have three children now. So my wife carried our first and that was three failed attempts, a miscarriage, and then we had our eldest on the fifth attempt. Wow. And then we decided a few years later, once she started sleeping, which was difficult, to try again. But this time I would be the birthing parent.
Yeah.
So we went for two natural cycles of IUI and amazingly, I was very negative. I was like, it's not going to happen. It just happened. So we were really, really lucky. And we're both from really big families. And we're like, do you know what? Our family's not complete yet. Let's go for it. Just before the pandemic, which was really helpful. So we had, I went to carry again, three failed IUIs. Further tests led to me having secondary infertility. It just had halved my ovarian reserve in like 2 years, which was really shocking. Don't smoke, don't drink, look after myself. Don't know what happened, but it happens. Took us by surprise. So we moved to IVF. Pandemic hit, lockdown, everything cancelled, which was really difficult, of course, for so many people at the start of their journey or continuing their journey. So we waited it out, got physically, psychologically fit and ready, went for an IVF round, a fresh transfer, failed, two embryos transferred. We were like, what is going on? And then the fifth attempt, we got lucky and we had our littlest, our third little, who's now 16 months. So we've got an 8-year-old, a 4-year-old and a 16-month-year-old. But obviously that journey was the beginning through to now, you know, we're much more informed now, but that's why we set the organisation up, because back then we just had no support, no community for people like us to come for that information, that guidance, that just that sense of spirit and celebration and visibility of families like ours, to usualise families like ours. So we wanted to do good. And then it led from there, really.
So 8 years ago, and it's I think about this quite a lot, the fact that people going through this process now, it's still obviously tough and challenging, but actually there is more information out there. How was that I guess it was more than 8 years ago, because over 10 years ago. How was that kind of starting that process? What did that feel like in terms of trying to navigate through that?
Just really isolating. Just didn't feel visibly represented, just didn't see families like ours, even on adverts. Like now you'll see certain brands doing that tick box exercise, other brands doing it much better and wanting to you know, usualize and represent our families and celebrate them. But back then there wasn't anything. We didn't know anyone. We knew of one local woman who was single who'd just started having babies. But other than that, no one locally in our county that we knew of was having babies. There was nothing really on social media. There was no presence, no visibility. So it was a struggle. It was isolating. And there was no one to really have those conversations of, this might happen to you. You might experience this discrimination, these microaggressions, these assumptions. This is how you counteract them and turn it into a positive. This is how you deal with these things. We didn't have any of that. So we just had to muddle through it. And we did have some really difficult times. But that was just the way it went. So I think those experiences have helped us inform and support and shape the guidance that we give to others, because unless you know what it looks like, the journey, yeah, and you know what's coming and the hurdles and the barriers you'll have to go through, you don't know how you're going to deal with them. And it's a lot more positive if you're more aware of what's going to happen.
And that kind of discrimination you talk about, like, give me a flavour of what that looks like, the kind of barriers and discrimination and microaggressions that you see.
I think we've always had them. Even we've noticed that hasn't really changed or moved on since we had baby one to baby three. But the kind of, oh, is this your sister? Or, oh, is this Nana or Grandma? You know, some of the things that, or, you know, oh, have you brought a friend with you? No, yeah, it's my wife. And it's the discombobulation, the look of confusion when people are like trying to work it out. It takes about 10 seconds. They go, oh, I'm really sorry. And it's like, we know that in most cases, there's no ill intent. You know, you yes. have to take that on the chin. But at the same time, society has to move forward. Education and training needs to be mandated. You know, we do a lot of work with the government. Look at these areas, because healthcare professionals, people in society should not just make an assumption that just because you're two women, you've got to be related or best friends. You can't actually be married. So yeah. a lot of things like that. But then we went through things like, no one had had the conversation with me as a non-bio, non-birthing parent, that people would invalidate my role. So no one told me that someone would, the day after our daughter had been born, turn around and say, I don't want her, get her out, I want the real mum. And, you know, had someone told me that, I would have known how to deal with it and counteract yeah. it. But that day, you know, will live with me forever. That was a mar on our experience as mums, to be told that and be refused to be dealt with because I wasn't the biological or birthing parent. And it lived with me and it really impacted my journey. So things like that level of discrimination, you know, you're not the real mum, you're not seen as valid. But also, you know, the sneers you would get, you know, you would still get that kind of thing. And you still do. You still get those experiences where people will not deal with you or will be like, oh, lesbians, oh, LGBT people, or the eye rolls, or, oh, of course they're gay. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes the experiences can be worse than that. And some people have really, especially trans and non-binary people, really difficult birthing and parenting experiences.
So when you went from your wife being the birthing parent the first time and then you were the birthing parent the second time, did that help you navigate the experience for each of you, how the other one had experienced things the first time and helping to kind of find ways to navigate the other role the second time you went through it?
Yeah, I think it was difficult, and it was probably incredibly difficult for my wife, and we talk about it a lot in the work we do, because I know that I had no fear about being a non-birthing, non-gestational, non-biological parent for the whole 9 months. There was nothing in my mind, even in the implications counselling with the fertility counsellor, to say, have I got to worry about that? Is that something that I feel insecure about? I wasn't insecure at all. And the only time I was insecure was that at that pinnacle moment when that doctor refused to deal with me and referred to me basically as not the real mum. And that then caused a fallout of my behaviour, my insecurities coming to light, my questioning my validity, me coveting the baby, stopping family from being around her, saying, you don't need to stay, I'll deal with her, I'll feed her. And, you know I put a lot of pressure on my wife at that time, and I look back and I feel guilty, because I feel like, you know, she had a lot to deal with. She'd just given birth to our child, been through a miscarriage, been through our journey. But there's so many women and people that have exactly the same experiences because of the microaggressions or the discrimination that people place on their journey and how they treat them. So I look back now and I think that was really difficult. But when the coin flipped, I felt like I was much more mindful of ensuring that she was involved in everything. So at appointments, if people were about to make an assumption, I would quickly jump in and I would say, yeah, because we were prepared, I would say, this is my wife, she's the other mother, that's how she'd be referred to, pronouns she, her, all those things, so that I got in there first. I didn't want her to ever feel the way I was made to feel, because I know how that felt. And I just wanted to make sure she felt secure. And she's a very stoic, you know, mature person that can get through things like that. And I'm sure she would have had an answer to anyone that counteracted that. But for me, I wanted to make sure she felt loved. She felt validated and supported as a parent. So I think when that coin flipped, I made sure that she was visible and she was just as much a part of the journey as I was. And that's important.
And you find yourself doing that, don't you? Jumping in and almost trying to give your life history in 10 seconds so that it stops people from making those. I find myself doing it all the time, because if I mention that of a child, people will automatically then read you as straight and start asking me questions about my wife, for example. Yeah. And so I just find like I drop in that I've got a husband as early on into the conversation.
So you have to out yourself all the time.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
We call it the second coming, because it is literally like you just don't come out. The minute you start that journey, you're consistently having to come out at the doctors, at the dentist, in the supermarket. You know, I would do it in, you know, to make sure people knew that we were both mums. During that difficult period, people would go, oh, baby's lovely. And I'd go, I'm her mum too. I'd be like, yeah, I'm her mum as well. But because I was trying to deal with these emotions and the confusion of being invalidated, so I would overcompensate in every situation. Now I don't care. And I'll be like, yeah, I'm her sister. Yeah, she's my mum. You know,
it's easier sometimes, isn't it, though? It's just easy. Like, yeah. I know Doug gets such anxiety about going to the barbers. Because when he's in the barbers and they start having conversations, he's like, oh, what's going to happen? How is this conversation going to go? And what am I, you know, what am I going to have to
We do that with tradesmen, because if people think we're two women, they think we're, and you know, just going to be stupid and we don't know anything about anything. So it's kind of like you just have to kind of go with it and go, yeah, my husband will be back later. Yeah, my partner, he will do that. Or yeah, he'll get back to you. Because if you say you're two women, you either feel like you put yourself in a vulnerable position, or people make assumptions, or it goes the other way. And we have had experiences where people have been quite discriminatory. So it's that kind of protection level as well, that you feel that sometimes it is better to just lie. It's just an easier life. Other times you feel it's an educational opportunity and people generally want to know. But yeah, I can imagine that the barber's blessing.
but I think that what you're talking about there as well, about that double discrimination, because I think often when people think about like intersectionality and different identities that we have, you know, people think about race and gender, but don't necessarily think about how lesbian women or bi women or will have those, that double discrimination as well, from getting the homophobia, biphobia, transphobia and the misogyny that goes with it at the same time.
Yeah, and that's the thing. People will automatically assume that you don't know anything about anything. And then the fact that you're a lesbian means that, you know, you're only from that community and you don't have any views on anything else other than being gay and rainbows and hearts and flowers. No, you know, pride is pride. We all celebrate it, but it's not, you know, my identity isn't just about being gay. I'm a mother. I'm a wife. I'm a daughter. I'm a sister. I'm a friend. There's so many parts to me and, you know, you and whoever in our community. Just because you're LGBT plus doesn't mean that's just your whole identity, who you are. But yeah, having to battle off being a woman, being gay, being a parent, being from a, you know, a small minority marginalized community, you do feel that sometimes it's like, oh, here we go, we'll have to do this again. But we try and make it a positive where we can.
Yeah,
we try and educate, but sometimes you just have to give up and go, okay, I'm a sister. Yeah.
It's amazing that you are then taking those experiences and turning them into a positive through your organization, LGBT Mummies. When did you start that and how did that come about?
When we had our first, it kind of was a light bulb moment when we were in the recovery room and we'd had our daughter. And my wife was laying there and the nurse running in scrubs with a pad and a pen. And we thought she was going to take notes about the birth. And she said, I'm really sorry to interrupt and I really hope you don't mind, but can I ask how you had the baby and the process? I've got friends like you and I hope you don't mind. I mentioned you last night at dinner and they asked me to ask you. So we gave her all the information. We were kind of like, that's the information we needed when we started.
Yeah.
So after we had her, we were consistently being contacted and it just was frequent. It was always, all the time. And it was weekly in the end, at the, you know, in the GP surgery, in the supermarket, you know, at school gates with friends of friends. And it was just happening all the time. And then by the time we had baby two, we had him and I was just like, do you know what? We need to do something. We need to use our experiences as a force for good and use it to make a purpose to support other people, because people were coming to us in such a flux of anxiety of there's just no information out there, or it's very fragmented and it's not fully inclusive and it's just not supportive. There's no community. So I was like, I'm going to set up a community and I'm going to do a, like an event or something like that. And within 6 months, it had blown up. We were global. We were a global community. We'd been invited to Downing Street. We were part of the Stonewall 30th anniversary campaign. And we were just having conversations at a very strategic level within government. I met with the Government Equalities Office because I was like, do you know what? I'm not happy about this. These things impact not only our family, but others in the community. We need this law. We need these policies, these guidelines looking at. So it kind of escalated very, very quickly. So now we're like sitting around 50,000 globally, but we do, we have our community that share and celebrate the journeys and, you know, inform and give guidance, but also we do a lot of policy and campaign work. We work with the NHS, we work with the government and other royal colleges to say, look, this is our community. You need to educate your staff. You need to support us better. You need to bring people in our community in, and we bring people from our community into this research, these study pieces, these guidelines to say, this is what it needs to look like. But it's not just for LGBT mums or people that identify as mums. It's for all families. So we're very aware acutely that trans and non-binary people, genderqueer people are at the moment under such scrutiny and discrimination, and they need that support. So making sure that we are standing up and being allies and holding the government and the NHS and society to account and saying, well, hold on, okay, gay dads and gay mums, we're a bit more accepted, that's fine, but what about trans? What about non-binary people, genderqueer people? What about co-parenting? What about polyfamilies? What about intersex people? What about all these people that are even smaller minority community within our community? And then, like you said, adding that intersectionality of being Black and queer and, you know, non-binary or trans and, you know, supporting those people. What does that look like? How can we improve that? So for us, it's about making good from our experience and making sure that people feel less isolated and they feel that there's a safe haven and a community for them. Because right now, for a lot of our community, there isn't. It's a very scary time. And I think COVID's played a lot of havoc in that, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the experience, I think, of becoming parents is like a stressful one enough for anybody. And then if you add on to that all the inequalities in the health system, the discrimination that people face, just having, you know, like you say, for trans people, often just from speaking to trans people, I know just leaving the house and going out into the street and existing is really scary at the moment because of the negativity that comes from particularly sections of the media and also politicians. And you mentioned before about, in particular, kind of pathways to parenthood for trans non-binary people are more challenging. I guess a lot of the time people talk about the LGBT community as like this one homogenous group that is all the same, but actually there must be real distinctions in the experiences of lesbian, gay, bi and trans non-binary people when they go through the path to parenthood.
And that's the thing, you know, we can't speak up for everyone. We'll be allies and we'll fight for everyone and we'll advocate for everyone and we'll support who we can within our remit. And where we can't, we will refer people. You know, we've had, you know, Seahorse dads come to us and say, there isn't a space for us. You know, we don't get funding. You know, we have to work really hard to do what we can do. But is it within our remit to be able to support someone like that in the best way possible? Possibly not. But there are other people that can do that, that we can make those connections and ensure that there is a safe space for them, but also for advocate for them and get them involved in studies and research and say, hold up, you haven't got a trans dad on that panel. Get that stakeholder involved to make sure that their experiences and their outcomes can be bettered, because right now they're really poor. Yeah. The items report, as you know, just that kind of lays bare what their experiences are like. But for people like that right now, it's a really scary, really traumatic time. Like you said, and I said, existing is difficult for many people. So for us, it's really important that those voices are heard throughout a lot of the work we do, regardless of whether it's a space that we can provide support, but pulling people in so that they can make changes for their community too. And like you said, we're not just one kind of monolith. You know, there's so many different intersectionality within our community, whether you're of colour, whether, you know, your gender, your sexuality, whether you're a parent or not, whether you're single, whether you, you know, whether you have additional requirements or needs, that there's so many of us and we're a myriad of really beautiful human beings, but we need to be celebrated, we need to be supported, and we need to get improvements made now. So, you know, it's really, really important that we come together collectively to do that.
Wow. And you've, and you know, you've been doing the work a long time, and I know like recent win, which I know you will have had, you've had a big input into, will be the fertility equality legislation, or the what they're going to be passing as part of the women's health strategy.
Yeah. And again, we could sit there and go, hooray, women's health strategy, you know, women's health strategy kind of needs to be reframed. Adjective language needs to be used, but also the minute it came out and we read through it and we were like, yeah, let's celebrate. It's a landmark historical move to remove that level of discrimination with the costs. But when you boil down to the nitty gritty, you know, we met with the Department for Health and Social Care after that and said, hold up, you didn't use non-binary people language in that documentation. Are they included? Yes, they are. I said, well, that needs to be added. What about single people? Oh, no, they're not. They don't qualify. They don't get funding. Right. So that's discriminatory. What about gay dads that want surrogacy, that want to have a child that's genetically related to them? Oh, well, it's a women's health strategy. So there's still people and pockets and minorities within our community that we're like, well, hold up, just because we've got a bit further along the path, what about the people we've left behind? So that's not good enough. You can't have equality for some and not for all. So for us, there's still a long way to go. And we were quite disappointed with it. You know, we wanted to celebrate it, but at the same time, be mindful to people, this is the current situation. It might not fully change December's the review, and then localized ICBs, integrated care boards, decide how they make that, how they use that funding. So they might go, we've reviewed it, we want to invest in COVID recovery rather than funding fertility. So for heterosexuals and LGBT plus people, women are removing it. There's your opportunity gone. So pockets of people across the UK will still not have access. So it's still disparate. So you're not really increasing, you're removing one level of discrimination and continuing another. So for us, it needs to be re-looked at a national level. They need to review it for everyone, not just LGBT plus people, but heterosexuals too. You know, maybe look at it and say, oh, we'll means test it. We'll give it to people from areas of social deprivation and people of a certain household income who can't afford private treatment or that sit within a certain income bracket. Do that. Then you can provide it to as many people as possible, but don't provide it to people based on where they live. Don't provide it on people based on their sexuality or gender. You know, we've moved forward, but then there's still a lot of change that needs to happen. And I think gay dads should be able to access surrogacy. If a gay woman or women can access, why can't gay dads? You know, it can't just be one rule for one and then others get left out.
Well, your attitude's amazing, I think, because, you know, I guess I'm reflecting now thinking, well, I went, wow, this is amazing, and fell into that trap of, you know, often that is what happens with minority groups, is that the government or
give us a golden nugget.
We'll be like, yeah, exactly. And then and then we'll go, woo, great. And then when you kind of, as you've just done that analysis and dig deeper into it, there's still a lot more to do. And, you know, we need people like you in this world who are holding things to account and taking that level of detail analysis to make sure that these things are inclusive of everybody. And I guess particularly when, I know we've in the past kind of few weeks, there was recently the Tory party conference, and there were quite a lot of anti-trans kind of messages that were coming through that. And so, you know, like you say, when the trans inclusive language isn't used in something like the women's health strategy, you know, how do we make sure that these pieces of legislation, good as they may be for parts of the community, are then filtering through to everybody?
Exactly. And it's just a case of additive language isn't difficult. It may look a bit uglier, it may be a bit longer, but it just means that all people are included. No one wants the erasure of women or men or mothers or dads. No one's asking for that. Our community aren't asking for that. We just want to be included. People want a seat at the table. They want to stick their head above the parapet and know that if they stand up for our community, that they're not going to be vilified. You know, we've had hate crimes against us and our family, against the organisation, that have been really difficult, that we've had to report to the police. And we shouldn't have to be in that position. No one should. But for those in our community that are still not getting access to appropriate inclusive care, you know, that additive language can make the difference. And when you have that conversation at a strategic level and say, the difference between you adding and people, women and birthing people, to your booking referral form or your sign that sits in a GP surgery is the difference between someone that could self-harm, someone that could miscarry because they free birth and there's an issue and they lose their baby, the difference between someone committing suicide because they have no access to trans healthcare. That's the difference. That's the implication. If you don't use additive language, and that's as serious as it gets bad. And yeah. It's only when you lay that out on the table in front of people, they go, oh, well, it can't be that bad. They, you know, you have gay marriage and you have this, and now you've got the women's health strategy. But what about the rest of them? What about those people that are on suicide watch, that are, you know, having to have CBT and counselling, and or aren't even out? You know, they're not in a safe space at work. They're not in a safe space at home. You know, there are people that are in these situations that it's a life or death. And that's not being dramatic. That's not being, you know, over the top. That is just reality of some people in our community's lives right now, especially with certain newspapers and media outlets, the way they, you know, play the fiddle and, you know, the way they misconstrue people's identities and journeys to make trans, non-binary, genderqueer people in our community like demons. It's disgusting. And it needs to be addressed. But we've all got to come together to do it, because if we don't, it's just going to get worse. It's just going to get worse.
And yeah, that collective power that comes with groups of people getting together and kind of helping to effect change is super important. And what about, so we talked a bit about kind of access to becoming parents and going through fertility journeys or whatever those paths may be. What about when people actually become parents and the experiences that they then have? So I know for me, when our daughter was born, and every single time when I was going into the doctors for those initial checkups and whatever, I had to keep on correcting them and keep on saying something. And I actually emailed the clinic in the end, our local GPs, and said, look, I you know, I don't want to make a fuss, but I am starting to, you know, it's impacting us that every time I come into the clinic, I'm having to explain our family situation to the receptionist with an entire, you know, waiting room behind me listening in. And, you know, can you just put a note on our file that just says that our daughter has two dads so that we don't have to go through this every time? And to their credit, they actually said that they'd identified this as a challenge, and they were doing the, I think LGBT Foundation do some training on this as well. And they were doing that training, which is great. But I guess, how do you, you know, drive those different behaviors? So that, because there's one thing that happens at policy level, we've also talked about how do you actually educate people in service delivery to kind of treat people in an inclusive way.
Yeah, and that's the thing, you have that kind of high-end strategic level, but then you have a localized level whereby they're not being fed the information drip fed down, because those changes take a long time to happen. People go, but you're working on this, you know, they come to us and say, we know you're working on this, where are we at with it? And we're like, this could be a 2-3 year process. This is something that won't happen overnight, and you've got to drip feed it out nationally. But at a localized level with like GP surgeries, we had it too. You know, when I met with the Government Equalities Office, and I sat there and I said, I take my daughter for an ear infection to the doctors with my wife and have the same as you, and go in, and he goes, okay, what's wrong with her? And we say, and who's the mum? Oh, I am. Oh, I am. Oh no, she's the birth mum. I'm the non-birth mum. Right. Confusion, absolute confusion, discombobulation of what is it? And then it's, oh, okay, but what about the dad? Oh, and there's no dad. There's a donor. A donor.
Yeah.
What kind of donor? A sperm donor. What, you know him? No. Oh, okay. So how did you find him? This all it's is like, played out in front of your child.
What relevance does that make? It's exactly. Like, why does that matter?
History? All these things happen in front of our child. Yeah. Who then walks out and goes, but I don't have a dad. I have two mums, and this is my family. And she relays her journey at a very young age to have to consistently go through this confusion of, but hold on, why don't they understand what my family journey looks like? It's really difficult for our children. And, you know, at that meeting, they sat there and was like, oh my gosh, that's awful. And I was like, yeah, it is. But imagine that replicating for every single family in the UK within our community, and having to have really difficult conversations because people explain in different ways to their children. Not everyone is as open, and that can lead to really difficult conversations. Mm. But also at that level, why is it not in the system? And it was something that we made recommendations to the government. You know, there needs to be a field, a space within the system, the software, to say additional notes, you know, whether there's a dad or a donor. What is the donor's history? What is the language you use? Is there a bio, non-bio mum? Is there multiple parents? You could be a co-parenting family. You could be a poly family. You know, these families exist, and there's no space for them to exist right now. Even for our families in the software, there's no space for us to exist. So make the space, make that change. You know, it's going to take time, but these are the kind of things that as a parent, you then experience along that journey, you know, from the doctors to the dentist to at the school gates, having to have these conversations, the second coming, at every turn. But the system isn't built for us right now, is it?
And I think it can sometimes sound a bit trivial. It's like, oh, what's the big deal? Like just having to explain it every time. But I think the worry is, when I think about it, is that can actually have an active impact on people's health outcomes, because if people are worried about having these conversations when they go in and having to explain lots of things, I think, you know, that's, we know from history that, for example, the LGBT community's access to healthcare is impacted by people asking questions or people feeling uncomfortable when they go in this situation. Yeah. So people don't go to the doctors when they've got something wrong with them because they're worried about having these conversations, but then they could end up having poorer health outcomes because they've got issues that go undetected.
Yeah. And people will go online and they will get medication on the black market because they can't go to their GP because they don't want to explain that they're transitioning or that they need to stop transitioning to have a baby or that they need access to additional care. Because like you said, people don't want to stand in a room or have a conversation over the phone with a stranger about their situation and be judged. And I think the sentence that you said just hit me, really, that I didn't want to make a fuss. I didn't want to make a fuss. We're conditioned to feel like we're making a fuss by asking for equal access. We're not asking for more. We're not asking for more than anyone else. We just want equal access. We just want the space to be there and created to fit us, and the system's not fit for purpose, and that's the problem. So having to have those conversations consistently is something that we're saying needs changing. You need to build the system to ensure all people are there. And we do obviously a lot of work locally as well with our maternity and hospital system within the NHS, and we've done a new booking referral form, and it means that trans, non-binary, genderqueer, any type of parent that you become on the journey to become through birth, you will now get a form that you look at and go, okay, I can fill this out. I know that the midwife will read it, know my situation, and know the appropriate level of care to give me. That's all it is. It's not hard to give equity and equality and access to everyone. So it just needs to be done. We can't be seen to feel like we're making a fuss when we ask for equal access.
That's so true. And what would you say to people, or what advice would you give people who are starting their journey potentially to becoming parents? What do you wish someone had told you when you were starting your journey?
I wish that there was an organisation like us that I could have gone to just to find out what those difficult, uncomfortable conversations were. And I think as an organisation, we're very positive. We want to shine light and celebrate our journeys, but we're very aware that it can be a difficult journey. So you've got to have those really uncomfortable conversations that you may be told you're not the real dad, you're not the real mum. You might experience discrimination because of your journey or your decision. You know, we have people come to us that have used home insemination. Absolutely amazing. They've had a great experience, but people judge them because they didn't go for a private clinic. How wrong is that? Everyone's path to parenthood should be celebrated and supported and validated. And people shouldn't be made to feel like they've chosen the wrong path based on their choices or their situation. There's people that have to choose additional routes because legalities and the law doesn't support the path that they wanted to go on. So they've got to go down an alternative route. If you're not married, if you're not civil partnered, you don't get this access. You've got to go down that cis heteronormative route just so you can make sure that you're on the birth certificate. That's wrong.
Yeah.
You know, for people starting the journey, you know, guys like you know, families like yours, like ours, organisations like us, Stonewall, Mermaids, people that are in the community that are supporting LGBT plus people, people on the path to parenthood, Two Dads UK, people that have been on that journey and talk about the ugly truth, but also celebrate it. And you've really got to go in it with your eyes open. You've got to be positive, but you've got to be aware that there's going to be a tough time and you need to know how to deal with it and counteract it. And having a support network around you is really important. So if you haven't got it at home, if you haven't got friends that understand it, if your workplace isn't inclusive and supportive, if you feel brave enough, make the change, advocate for yourself. But if you can't, we'll advocate for you. There's others in the community that will be your safe space, will be your haven, and we'll come together and we'll get you through it. And like, we have support groups that people can join. And again, they're global, because it's nice that people in Texas can speak to people in Russia that have such a different experience, or people in the UK to Australia, and say, I'm on the same medication as you, or I'm going down the same adoption journey as you, because there's something when people come together in that safe space that you feel connected, but you feel valid. And for us, that was the most important thing we wish we had, that we felt valid, but we were represented. And just had someone that you could pick the phone up or a message and go, oh my gosh, I'm going through this, this is hard, or this is great, or this is amazing. And, you know, that's what we wish we had, and that's what people need. So that safe space. So reach out. There's enough of us around now to share the love and support.
Wow. That's such a pragmatic, practical, positive, but pragmatic and practical kind of advice. And so, you know, it's been absolutely incredible talking to you. Just to repeat, LGBTmummies.com is your website. There's loads and loads of support and resources and information on there, and at LGBTmummies on Instagram. I guess people can get in touch with you on there as well. So thank you so much for an enlightening conversation. And and see you soon.
See you soon.
That's it for this week on the Proud Parent Club podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show, and don't forget there's a new episode every week, so make sure you follow and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Also, for exclusive previews of next week's show, give us a follow on Instagram and TikTok at the Proud Parent Club. See you next week.